Want to introduce the people on the panel who will probably share a little bit more about themselves before I go ahead and explain the 12 steps. This is Wendy, Bill, Peter, and myself, Jackie. So you'll hear from all of them as well. How many here have ever heard of 12-step groups or have, oh boy, so I'm really among friends. That's great. As somebody once said, when the question was asked, how do the 12 steps work? They said they work just fine, thank you. And that's maybe a place to begin. If you seem more mystified or confused about what the 12 steps are about, welcome to the club after you've come here. My own first experience was back in 1975. I did some work at an Indian reservation in northern Minnesota. And you know, amongst the native population, that alcoholism runs rampant. And there was a counselor there who introduced me to AA, and that kind of became my beginning, and I was really impressed with that. And then I started working in the field after that of alcoholism treatment. Just a bit about the history of AA. Peter's talked about that in some of his sessions. I'd reference those tapes. But it began 50 years ago, or 55 years ago, in 1935, when a couple of people came together, a doctor and a stockbroker, and they later, I think, came up with the steps actually in 1939. And it wasn't begun by a brilliant therapist, but rather two alcoholics who were just trying to get sober and stay that way. It has some roots in the Oxford movement, which was a post-World War I movement, or Oxford groups rather, that was kind of an evangelical Christian group, and it has some origins there. From that developed Alcoholics Anonymous. I think after that came Al-Anon, Gamblers Anonymous, Overeaters Anonymous, Emotions Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, Schizophrenics Anonymous, Parents and Families Anonymous, Mistresses Anonymous, Cocaine Anonymous, Adult Children. It's basically for anybody who's addicted to religion, sex, money, shopping, relationships, or worrying. And some people might even say people get addicted to the 12 steps. Some consider it the most powerful therapy in America today. A little bit about the description of the organization. It's not connected with any religious denomination, cause, or organization, and they're very firm about that. There are no hard and fast rules. There are no fees. It has a minimal amount of organization. It's based on attraction rather than promotion. There's never any recruitment that goes on. Newcomers are warmly welcomed. There is always acceptance and understanding. They come together to share experience, strength, and hope. It's informal and voluntary. There are no paid staff. There is a prescription for recovery and for living in what we call the 12 steps. It's non-professional. It's leaderless. Everything is optional. There's help available anytime, and it's a self-directed pace. You don't sort of do step one week, step two the next week, and so forth. Now, a little bit about the 12-step program. It's a philosophy of life. It's harmonious with one's own personal theology and spiritual beliefs. As they say, the house that AA or 12-step groups helps one to build for oneself is different for each occupant, because each occupant is their own architect. For many, AA or 12-step groups is a kind of coming home or going home, a return like the prodigal son to the house and the faith of his fathers. To others, it's a never-ending journey into lands they did not dream existed. It doesn't matter into which group one falls. It's one of many creative tools available to people. It teaches people how to live peacefully, happily, successfully, promoting healing and bringing peace. Some have called it a radically different understanding of spiritual power. It's very simple. In fact, they kind of use a phrase, it's called KISS, keep it simple, stupid. It has humble realism that is both rare and convincing. It's not religious, yet 6 of the steps will put you in direct contact with a loving God you're not required to understand. I'll mention some other elements. The Serenity Prayer, written by, in its long form, by Reinhold Niebuhr: God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference, is one of its very strong components, and it's usually said at every meeting. There's an element of sponsorship, which is where people are encouraged to find somebody who kind of has what you want, and to allow them to kind of be a guide through the 12 steps that you're to have kind of regular contact with. And that's called sponsorship. Meetings, going to meetings is a very big part of working the program. It means going to maybe a regular home group, or going to meetings when you're traveling. They exist all around the world. Slogans are a big part of it. Things like keep it simple, let go and let God. Help me with some other ones.
Just for today.
Take it easy. One day at a time. Easy does it. To thine own self be true. There's just kind of trite little phrases that you hate sort of to be thrown at you, and yet are with
right where you need to be.
Profound wisdom. Yeah. Besides the 12 steps, they also use the 12 traditions, which are kind of principles that guide the organization, perhaps. Is there another way to maybe describe them? Somebody summarized for me the 12-step program one time with 6 words that were, and I think Bill W., one of the founders of the program, Bill Wilson, used, and they were trust God, clean house, and serve others, which I think is a pretty good way to describe the program. Some people have said, well, is it therapy? Is it treatment? You know, what is this sort of 12-step stuff? And so I'm going to read a really short story that I think captures for me what it's all about. Picture ourselves standing on the shore. Way across the water is an island that we call Serenity, where peace and happiness and freedom exist from the despair of alcoholism or other addictions or problems. We really want to get to that island, but we've got to find a way to get across the water, that huge void that stands between us and where we want to be. We have 2 choices. In the water is an ocean liner, a cruise ship that looks real posh and cozy. It's called treatment, therapy. Next to it, on the beach, sits a group of odd-looking people. They appear to be rowing a boat, but we can't see a boat and we can't see the oars. We only see these happy people sitting on the beach, rowing an invisible boat with invisible oars. The invisible boat is called AA or any other 12-step program. The ocean liner haunts, summoning us aboard the treatment and the therapy cruise. We can see the people on board. They're happy and they're waving to us. Then there are these goofy people hollering at us to join them in their invisible boat. Would we choose the liner or the invisible boat? Of course, we'll get on the ocean liner, the luxury cruise. The next thing we know, we're heading toward that island of happiness. The problem is, about midway across the water, the ocean liner stops, turns around, and heads back to the shore where we started from. Then the captain orders everyone off the ship. And when we ask why, he says, our cruise only goes so far. The only way you can ever get to that island is by getting in the invisible boat with the goofy people. So we shrug our shoulders and walk over to the people in the boat. Get in, they holler. We can't see any boat to get into, we holler back. Get in anyway, they say. So we get in. And pretty soon, they say, pick up an oar and start rowing, working the steps. Can't see any oars, we holler back. Pick them up and start rowing anyway, they say. So we pick up invisible oars and start rowing. And pretty soon we see the boat. Before we know it, We see the oars too. Next thing we know, we're so happy we're on the boat with the goofy people, we don't care if we ever get to the other side. Richard Rohr, a Catholic priest, has called the 12 steps an amazing gift of the Spirit. The spirituality behind them can be solidly founded in the scripture and tradition, yet they claim not to be Christian. They're clear, practical distillations of centuries of religious wisdom presented in a way that avoids all smokescreen, piety, and soft devotion. People don't hang around the 12 steps unless they want to change their life. It counters the individualism of our culture. As you can see in the very first tradition, it says our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends on AA or OA or whatever unity. The second tradition sees God expressed and known in community. There's no private kind of me and Jesus here. It says, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he or she may express him or herself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. And so while the whole church argues over what's true ordination, 12 step groups are saying we're all but trusted servants. Their PR policy is based on attraction rather than promotion, and so truth, like beauty, it sells itself. Spirituality of the 12 steps have been compared to Latin American-based communities. It's kind of the low church approach to evangelism and healing, or maybe the first world answer to base communities that are growing in Latin America. In many ways, as I said the other night, our suffering is psychological, relational, and addictive. And the suffering of people who are comfortable without, but oppressed and empty within. It's a crisis of meaninglessness and false self trying to find meaning in possession, prestige, and power. And it doesn't work, so we turn to ingesting and buying to fill our empty souls. There are six clear movements at work in the 12 steps, and I'll underline acceptance and commitment as even separate. But there's an acceptance, first of all, of what is, things exactly as they are, we learn. There's an acceptance of a limited self, a limited world with limited demands of all would-be brothers and sisters. So then only God is limitless, and everything else we have to learn to accept some limits on. Thirdly, there's a commitment, a real hearty commitment to truth. Truth about myself and truth about how I might have hurt other people or affected other people. There's a commitment to fellowship and community. Fourthly, there's an effort of meetings, apologies, responsibility for relationships are mandated with courage, and sponsorship is taken real seriously. Fifth, there's an unapologetic commitment to a personal God. Steps 2, 3, 6, 7, and 11 talks a lot of outside myself. And then six, there's a commitment to loving service. Spirituality is not a narcissistic trip. I'd like to just walk through the 12 steps, and I have these extra. For those of you who can't read them, I'm willing to pass these around. I'd like them back, but they're the 12 steps printed out for those of you who can't read what's up here. But I just want to read them out loud to you. Number one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Other groups substitute other words for the word alcohol. We could say over life, we could say over food, we could say over spending money, over relationships, over sex, whatever.
It says we.
It says we, right. Secondly, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. It's kind of the humility step and the trust that something bigger than us can restore us to sanity. Third, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God, and this is important, as we understand God. So that third one is a lot about surrender. Fourth, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. This is where the cleaning house bit part comes in. There's a repentance or an inventory kind of notion. And then finally, after that, we admit to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Kind of a repentance or a confession notion there. And then six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Doesn't say we have to remove them. And then seven, humbly ask God to remove them, our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all people we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. We don't have to make the amends yet, we just have to become willing to. And that's sort of the accountability that enters in. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. We try to be responsible about making those amends. 10, this is kind of the ongoing maintenance part of that. We continue to take personal inventory. And when we are wrong, promptly admitted it. So that's the honesty part. 11, this is often the spiritual one, or kind of called the spirituality step, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understand God, praying only for knowledge of God's will for us and the power to carry that out, kind of the spiritual discipline. And then 12, here is the help others notion. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics or to other people and to practice these principles in all our affairs. All our affairs. Well, what a demand, or what a request. What an order. I can't go through with it. At this point, I guess I want to invite our panelists to talk, and then we'll say a couple more things and open it up. You want to go first?
Yeah. Howdy, I'm Bill, and I'm an addict.
Hi, Bill.
Hi, Bill.
This, all my life to the 12-step programs. I'm not really speaking for the 12-step programs tonight. I'm just talking about me and some stuff that happened and kind of the way it was. How it was, what happened, how it is now. And how it is now is pretty nice compared to how it was. I started wanting to get clean. I started wanting to get clean for quite a while, but I really started making attempts in 86. I went to treatment center. And there had to be an easier, softer way than doing all that stuff, you know, and getting honest and making all those changes. And it didn't work. So I got to go out and hurt some more. And finally, I got hurt into willingness. And the 27th of November, 1988, I finally made a decision to do what it was going to take. And that's whatever it took. And that meant, you know, I didn't work a lot. And I went to a lot of meetings. And I cried and I hurt. And, I did a lot of stuff. But I haven't shot no dope since then. So it's been worth it. When I started, when I was a kid, God was a long ways off, you know, and I was told that it wasn't a close, I'm not sure if I was told this, what I heard was it was a long ways off, and it was really hard, you know, it was something I was going to have a hard time getting there because I wasn't feeling it. I liked sinning, so to speak, you know, and there was these things, you know, running around with women and getting drunk and stuff is not good. So I didn't feel like I had much of a chance of gaining this redemption, so I was just going to ride it, you know. I kind of felt like I was God's own doper, and I really did. You know, at times I really felt like that was my purpose on earth, was to do this, and I was going to do a real good job at it. I kind of jokingly say I'm a recovering Catholic now, you know, from the guilt and the shame and stuff. Because that's kind of how I looked at a lot of religion. It was like rules that I was being given to try to change me around. I couldn't understand them. I didn't like them. I really enjoyed the physical, you know, the sense pleasures and stuff. The church kind of, I saw it as giving me rules and a place to be. I was supposed to be this Jesus-like person, and I was this guy here. What the steps, you know, what 12-step people in 12-step programs mostly is, you know, like a 12-step program. There's no such thing as a 12-step program. It's a couple of addicts getting together because they don't want to get loaded today. And what I get from there is I get suggestions. You know, my sponsor, he's done stuff ahead of me, so he tells me what he did. And I don't get told I got to be here. I get told, if you want to grow, you can do this stuff. This is what I did. and I get to go to where I want to be. You know, I don't have to be so some people go to get rich, you know, there's people that end up, their life gets better and they make money. You know, there's no place you have to end up. I like that. Rules for me, I'm James Dean, you know, rules, and I rebel against them. So if somebody tells me I got to do something, I won't. If I hurt enough and somebody suggested I can quit hurting, I might try it, and I did try it. Some of the things, like it, within the meetings, it seems like some of the spiritual principles are practiced more. Like the golden rule, you know, doing to others. I try not to judge people because I don't like being judged. And I guess that's kind of, as I got some feelings, and as I got to not like the feeling of being judged, then I get some empathy for somebody else, and I see how that if I judge them, I deserve to be judged. See, that's stuff that Scripture says, you know, judge not. But I didn't, I like need it through experience, I guess. And some people get it as they grow up. In an information pamphlet, or an IP that I carry around with me, some people get this stuff on the way to growing up, and I didn't. You know, and I had to hurt enough to come and get it through the back door. We kind of look at it as being the counterculture sometimes. This is one big thing. I tended to, and a lot of addicts tend to judge their insides by your outsides. And that's really tough because a lot of religious people seem to always have, say everything's okay, you know, everything's fine. And hallelujah. And then I'm feeling miserable, and I think I want to be, you know, I should be like that. And I'm sure a lot of people that are acting that way hurt too, but they don't let it be known. See, and in a meeting, people tell me how they really feel and how much they hurt, and then that makes me okay because I hurt. And if I hear that you don't hurt, and boy, I know I really am weird, you know, I'm going to go out and get loaded because I don't like being different. I could use God today because of my Catholic, I don't know, because of something. I got a knot in my gut when I used God. And I don't know where that came from, but I just know that today it's okay. It's a really good, confusing word, you know, to describe a really confusing concept, so I can use it. Some of the things about Jackie, some of the things I wrote down here. Step 11, the addict's prayer, you know, get me out of this one and I'll never do it again. And, you know, like today I really do, I'm not God. One of the things I learned in treatment is that there is a God and I'm not it. So I do try to pray for God's will to be done because, you know, I don't know what's good for me. As it turned out, I'm really grateful for drugs. A lot of people live with stuff hampering them and uncomfortability their whole life and never hit a bottom. And by the grace of God, I hit a bottom and I get to grow out. And I don't know if I'm doing anything special, but I should be liking me a lot better than I used to. One of the neatest things I ever heard, a really good friend of mine, he helped me out a lot, said that the spiritual part of a 12-step program is like the wet part of water. I like that. And one of the things about this God as you understand him, her. God as you understand the principle of a higher entity. Pardon me. People don't have time, you know, like when you're sitting there really scared, you might go out and do that hot one that kills you. You don't have time to get a loving feeling for God. You got to do something right away. And this allows anybody to be saved, you know. It's, if you die tonight, it doesn't do any good, you know, to be working for something. So that's how come it has to be this way. Anybody can be saved through it. And it does work. I don't understand it. The more I know about it, the less I understand it. I just know that if I do that stuff, I don't got to do no dope. And that's why I keep coming back. Thanks.
Thanks, Bill.
Hi, my name is Wendy, and I'm a recovering bulimic and a compulsive overeater.
Hi, Wendy.
I follow give it my best shot at following the 12 steps and 12 traditions as Overeaters Anonymous sees them, which is really similar. If you substitute the word food in for about any place that says alcohol, it'll come out the same. I was thinking tonight, I walked down to the ballpark before I came in here, and I was trying to think of what the most important thing that I have gained from the 12 steps were, or is, because I think I continue to, at whatever point I'm at, learn something new and different. And the word that came to my mind was freedom. I have now something I didn't have before, and that is a freedom to accept me for who I am, and to accept my spirituality for what it is, not my particular church's spirituality or definition of church. I have a freedom now to accept other people for who they are instead of tolerate them and allow that to eat me up inside. And I'm really grateful. I am not an old hat at this. I'm an old hat at bad behavior. I've been bulimic for many years, and I'm relatively new to the 12 steps, and I've worked them in Overeaters Anonymous and as an adult child. One of the big issues for me is the surrendering issue. I really struggle with that, with completely turning over my will and my person to God, and just letting go of that, and knowing that it's going to be okay, and knowing that I don't have to fight that I don't have to go back to my room and eat everything in sight to make that okay. I know that it's okay now for me to leave Holden and not know where I'm going or what I'm doing when I leave here. Feels a little weird, but it's okay. But I do struggle with that, because I want to jump in and say, I kind of want to interrupt the process. I want to say, well, you know, maybe if I do this, then I can determine this outcome. And I can't. So, in thinking about how church and God relate to the 12 steps for me and my own program, that's kind of what I came up with. Thanks.
Peter? I really, I was exposed to 12-step programs beginning when I was a parish pastor. I suppose at some point prior to that, I'm sure that I had read the 12 steps and not really comprehended them. I had read somewhere that alcoholism was a disease, or that addiction is a disease, and I really didn't, I could understand that on an intellectual level, but didn't really have an appreciation for that. And it wasn't until I was a parish pastor, and I told you a story the other night, but I'll tell it again, had a next door neighbor who was over helping me install a window air conditioner. And I offered him a beer when we were done. It was a very warm Iowa summer, and he said, no thanks, I'm a recovering alcoholic. We got to talking a bit more, and he said, you know, as a pastor, you really ought to visit an AA meeting sometime. You ought to know what that's about, because there are a lot of your people in your church who are a part of this. And so sometime later I took him up on that, and I was really profoundly impressed and moved by that experience, to be together with that group of people who were as honest and open as that group was. And that's so, that really was my beginning point in my journey with AA and recovery and working with addiction, which I now do as a chaplain in a hospital, in a treatment center, in a hospital. In thinking about the kind of question that was asked tonight, or that we thought about in terms of this forum, I want to say that I see the 12 steps as a tool, and a very helpful tool. I think we could even say that they're God-given. You know? They're there for us to use. It works. Bill and Wendy have talked about how it works for them. I can say that in trying to use these myself, I think it does. I don't think that there is... I think Lutherans sometimes have kind of an allergy to anything that suggests that somehow we can kind of, in a stepwise fashion, gain a relationship with God. And I don't think that's what the 12 steps are about. I think sometimes we have reacted negatively to the 12 steps because of that. But I don't think that's what they're about. They're a way of getting healthy, and nothing less than that. And I think as such, they're a very helpful gift of God.
Okay. I think for years AA has been meeting in church basements, but and smoking probably a lot, and probably for a long time not much except the smoke probably went upstairs to the congregations, but that seems to be changing a lot, and religious leaders I think are beginning to suspect that more lives are maybe being transformed in the basements than in the pews. But we might ask ourselves, what are the lessons that organized religion could be learning from 12-step groups? Or what do you think the relationship to, you know, the church and 12-step groups might be? And we kind of had some discussion about, you know, are they friend or foe? Or how come some people feel more at home in some of those groups? And so we open it up to your participation. And
well, I'll start. I was real excited when I saw the title. I never understood fellowship until I started going to AA meetings. I grew up in the church, and fellowship was just another term, like justification, which I never understood. But it was just something that, you know, the preacher used a lot, and you'd hear tossed around. But it wasn't until I was at an AA meeting that I felt fellowship and felt the Spirit. The church has a lot to learn from the program. I'm in seminary, and we spend a lot of time talking about how to do ministry. And basically, I mean, a lot of people, it's no secret, in many ways the church is a dysfunctional organization in a dysfunctional society. You know, maybe sin is our dysfunction. I don't know, I mean, we're kind of talking in real general terms here. But the way a real dysfunctional model of ministry is what's going on in a lot of Lutheran churches, where you have the hair pastor who has all the answers, does all the work. People can't do anything without going to him or her and asking, whereas in the 12-step program, the individual is working with others to get things done, and it's always, I see it as a real clear thing that the person realizes that, okay, the basic part of my theology is I mean, the one thing that never wavers is that God is doing for me what I cannot do for myself. And that comes from the program. I just like to hear more from others about, you know, church and the relationship. Because my campus pastor did a Lenten series. His sermons were on the 12 steps of practical Christianity. I thought that was a great summary of what you said about the... and what that Catholic writer said about, you know, how it's clearly scripturally based and it's very Christian without using the word Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm. It's also, I read a lot of Eastern religions, and it's just right down the line, you know, compassion and helping fellow man and taking an inventory. That's some of the basic stuff before meditation. It's just, it fits in with just about everybody's spiritual base.
Others?
I think one of the things that's missing in the church is the common goal for the people that are going in those doors. Speaking as a Catholic, you know, you go every Sunday. It's not, I really, really want to be here. You know, not everybody's going there going, I really, really want to be here. Just, I was raised, this is what I have to do. So you don't come in like you would to an AA meeting, really wanting something for yourself and being able to share with the people, because not everybody there in the church is there for the same reason.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the difficulty.
I think another thing that's attractive in regards to these groups is that you don't go to one to become a Lutheran or a Catholic. You go because you have some needs to be met, including your spiritual needs. I think there's a lesson we learn about that in regards to things we do in the church, providing Bible studies for people, making sure that folks understand that they can come with no commitment to a particular denomination. We might see more people come if they understand that they don't have to become a particular kind of Christian in order to benefit from the activities we're doing in church.
I think one of the things that I've experienced when I've gone to AA meetings is the group's ability to listen. And I think a lot of times in churches, we're more concerned with teaching and trying to get them to learn something, when a lot of times all people really need is someone who listens. And that's real strong with those feelings.
It seems that one of the real gifts of 12-step programs, I have only a very minimal experience with it, but have a friend who's been part of it, and or several friends for whom it's been very important and very life-changing. It seems that the gift is the openness and honesty that's there. And I think that that's a big problem in church groups. Even when there are small groups getting together, very few people are willing to open up. I mean, some groups that does happen, but at a level of sharing that, you know, that you two opened up with us tonight. And I think that kind of honesty is what's needed for people to really share at fellowship, and for the Spirit to really be present in the churches. And I grew up in a somewhat dysfunctional family where we didn't talk about feelings. And I think that many of our churches, Northern European churches especially, tend to pretend there are no problems and not deal with conflict, not deal with negative feelings. And I it seems to me that that's one of the gifts that we could learn from.
Mm-hmm. Do you have your hand?
Yeah, it seems to me that one thing I struggle with addictions is, you know, where are the addictions, diseases, and where, I think the church tends to fall on the side of moral failings a lot of times, and addictions are the result of choices people make, poor moral choices, so they're becomes an ethical issue instead of a disease issue. It's hard for me when you see a husband who severely abuses his wife and child because he has a disease and then goes through a program and is forgiven by a lot of people, but the wife and the children's wounds aren't addressed or redressed, and I know that's one of the steps there, but I guess for me it's unclear to me how alcoholism and other things are diseases. Are they genetic diseases? Are they inherited? Are they...
Would you like someone to respond?
Yeah, if anybody would care, that might...
Let me do a little.
Sure.
There's all kind of medical brain chemistry stuff for alcohol, and quite a few other drugs fit in the same receptor sites as alcohol does, so quite a bit of it falls underneath there. For me, I never made a conscious decision that I wanted to screw my life up and spend years locked in a bathroom alone and lose two wives. You know, I didn't get out of high school and say that I really hope that I become impotent and broke and paranoid. You know, I didn't ask for that stuff. Kind of culturally for me, I was on a spiritual quest. I feel really lucky because I've kind of made a full turn. I'm about where I was when I got started right now. Long hair, looking for truth, hoping I can make the world a better place, trying to touch God, you know? You know, 1970 or 1969 revisited, you know? And that's cool. Because a lot of people get to die, getting to do the full circle. I was looking for God, and at the time, it was said that LSD was a quick road, you know? And being an addict, the easier, softer way I wanted it, I got in. You know, in order to do that, you start hanging out, and next thing you know, I don't really know when I crossed the line from the spiritual quest and doing drugs to kind of try to enlighten my mind to not giving a darn about nothing, you know, and I just wanted to be alone in the bathroom. I don't know when I crossed that line, but I woke up one morning and realized there I was. What happened to me was I, driving home from a week, and it was things were bad, and I looked in the rearview mirror and caught my eyes and started crying. You know, so that's how I felt about me. And I don't know. I don't understand the disease concept. I can't explain it to you, but I know I didn't make a conscious decision to end up where I ended up.
I think recently there was something in a paper where they think there is a gene that is a tendency to be alcoholic, is inherited. Not 100%, but there's a tendency. It's genetic.
My sense of it is, I'm aware of some studies that have been done that seem to indicate that there is a genetic factor for some addictions, though not all. There a genetic factor that leads to increased vulnerability to addiction. And for me, that makes some sense. Otherwise, how do we explain how some people can have a drink and not end up becoming addicted? Some people seem to be able to drink through their whole lives, and it doesn't seem to cause them any real problem. I'm aware of some, for instance, some twin studies that were done at the University of Minnesota, where they followed twins who were separated shortly after birth, and then were raised in separate environments. And in tracking some of that with addiction, it didn't seem to make any difference that they were raised in separate environments. If one was alcoholic, then the other one was. If one was chemically dependent, then the other one was. So I think there is something to the genetic part of it. But like I say, it isn't true for all addictions. The other thing that I'm aware of is that some chemicals, some drugs, are more addictive than others. Some drugs are more euphoric than others. And the more euphoric they are, the more addictive they seem to be.
I think the thought that came to my mind when Dan, when he asked the question, was, well, it doesn't matter unless, you know, you're searching for a reason to either some excuse to forgive or some excuse to condemn. And I don't think that's what we should be searching for. We should be, of course, searching for understanding. But if we're looking at it from anybody's religion, we should be looking to forgive and to love and to accept. Let me take forgive out, to love and accept that person and to understand that person. And I don't see that it has any relevance as to why the person is as he is. He is what he is, and we've got to go on from there. And that's what the 12-step program does. It just takes you from where you are today and deals with that.
I think backtracking a little, like I was talking to Bill the other night about, like if you're, I'm interested in the field of religious education, and if you're working with kids, and I don't really think that the only way people learn is by going through what Bill went through. And if you're going to try to troubleshoot kids who have potential problems by some way assisting them with the choices they're going to make, I guess the question for me is, can you do that if you know that, you know, if it's genetic, you can't troubleshoot people's genes. But if it has to do with moral or ethical choices people make, you can troubleshoot that to a degree.
But it's all still a choice. Bill made a choice. He had a choice to make, and it didn't matter whether it was in his genes or in his upbringing or anything else. He had a choice to make, and he made the choice.
Graduate school, my thesis work was with a guy who had done a lot on the genetic component, and he still continues to do that. And like he once said, speaking French runs in French families. And that's kind of the way alcoholism is. But I think Peter had a great response, and I would reference also his tapes in a couple of other sessions. He's really talked a lot about this, Dan. I think the whole area of prevention, though, is kind of an exciting and fascinating one, because I think there is something that can be done with the genetic information in the sense that we know that there's a tendency for it to run in families. You can be encouraging early evaluation, as well as helping kids to be attuned to the fact that they have a different response to alcohol if they have grown up in an alcoholic family than kids who have not. And which means in some ways that somehow when the chemical is introduced into the body, there is a different reaction. They have an intensified reaction to the mood-altering effect of certain chemicals. So that's a whole controversial area that prevention part is as well. But I would reference a lot of other things and kind of want to pull us back to the 12 steps. So, yeah, Dan?
I have a question. I hope it doesn't take us too far afield, but it's one that's very troubling to me, and then I need to preface it by saying I have really profound respect for people who are in 12-step programs and for the kind of powerful experience that is. But my question has more to do with the wider societal impact, and it's triggered by your comment of people asking, are 12-step groups the equivalent of the North American equivalent of the Latin American-based communities? One of the real fundamental differences I see, that there are many, many similarities in terms of the kind of support, the non-judgmental, the shared leadership rather than a hierarchical model, all those things are in common. But base communities, one of the things that is fundamental to them that gives them a tremendous amount of energy is that they directly attack the root causes of their oppression. And so they're involved, they are directly political in that sense. They gain an identity by working together to remove the causes of their oppression. And that seems to be a very basic difference from 12-step groups, which make it a very explicit, non-political stance. And the emphasis on practice is changing behavior, but not attacking societal roots of oppression or suffering. The reason I bring the question in terms of it being troubling is watching what has happened in my own community, the gay and lesbian community, where there has been a big shift of energy from attacking the source of oppression of gay and lesbian people to many people now being involved in gay and lesbian 12-step programs, which has been critically important and I think is a very, I think it makes us pause for what are they getting in those programs that they're not getting in the other areas of working for societal change. But my concern is, this is a very long-winded preface to this, my concern is if the 12-step program in some ways being manipulated by other societal structures that benefit from people not questioning what's causing the oppression in the first place, what's causing all these compulsive behaviors, what's causing dysfunctional systems, and whether or not the growth of 12-step programs addresses the behaviors but doesn't ultimately address what's wrong with our system that's generating this explosion of unhealthy behaviors.
I made the comment to Jackie the other day that my experience with people who really are following through with their 12-step program is that they are opened up to a whole different way of looking at things. That it need not be a very socially unaware kind of recovery. My sense is that when people are really working that 12-step program, they're extending themselves, they're reaching out into their community, are just simply much more open than they otherwise would be. So rather than kind of becoming wrapped up in themselves and in their own recovery, I think it does, you know, it does address the behaviors of the addictive behaviors. But there is at least potentially a room for a lot more there. But there's no way to control that. You know, that's really up to the individual that's involved in the program.
I would hope what you're really getting to is what, how to stimulate people beyond the 12 steps. Because if the 12-step program wasn't there, the person wouldn't have any interest at all in helping the rest of society. The person first has to help themselves. That's where the help comes from. Changes in society are not going to change the person who already has, you know, the problem or the addiction. A person has to take care of that themselves. They can go beyond that to help source, you know, conditions or something. They can do that afterwards, after they get a start on themselves.
And I certainly respect that. My concern is that I think our society has lots of roadblocks with that second step happening. And that's one of the distinctions is that in the Latin American-based community model to which these are being compared, that's explicitly integrated. I mean, a lot of attention is paid to the individual in the context of community and healthy behaviors, those kind of things. But it's always integrated with societal change as well, as recognizing that just changing individual behaviors won't ultimately be enough. So I just raise it as a question, and again, not meant as a critique or questioning the value of 12-step, but only wondering how the ultimate societal impact takes shape.
We got some anxious people.
Yeah. If I'm not shooting dope and not ripping you off and going to hospitals and telling people that they can stay clean, you know, it's changes, you know, it's more than just, I got to stay clean. If this is for me, you know, it is a selfish program. And I stay clean for me. A lot of times I go to hospital meetings for me. I don't go hoping I'm going to save the world. But it's a lot more than just me, you know, because it's her. And, you know, she's helped me, you know, I mean, that's, in a meeting, it's the newcomer, you know, the newcomer's the important person, and that's one more off the street, you know. And what another thing out of that is I find out that it's still ugly out there, you know, and it's us, it's an us, it's not a me. It's me, because if I'm alone, I'm in a bathroom, man, you know.
Wendy? I just have something real quick before we digress too far off of the topic, and just to speak a little bit from my own personal experience, what happened to me is that when I quit binging and purging, I discovered that I had a whole lot of time on my hands. Well, it sounds funny, but it's true. And, you know, there were all of these issues out there, and I had been really sympathetic for a long time about a lot of things. And what I discovered is that, you know, all the time that before I used to buy food or to be in my room alone or thinking, all of that time and energy I spent thinking about how I was going to get my fix or do whatever I was going to do, that time was open, and I could sit back and think, well, you know, I need this time for myself to work my program, but I still have this. And one of the neat things that came with my recovery was that I got to start to take a lot of pictures, and I got to start to use my color crayons a lot. I also started to work for Dorothy Day Center in St. Paul. And I don't think that my experience is really uncommon. I think for me, I did feel compelled to move on beyond myself, but not lose that focus. Because I knew that if I lost the focus on me, I wasn't doing anybody any good. I wasn't helping me, and I certainly wasn't going to help out anybody else. That's how it worked for me.
Scott, you had your hand up a while ago.
Well, I was going to ask what Dan did, but only I was going to ask someone to talk about what they perceived to be limitations.
What was that?
Limitations.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes I feel really bound. Sometimes I develop this fear that if I don't have my book of meditations and I'm not looking at the 12 steps and I'm not actively participating in at least one of the steps, that I'm going to go awry somewhere and that I'm going to end up back where I was. That's one of my own personal limitations.
Is that what you like that? Is that what you meant?
Well, what do you think are the limitations of the 12-step program?
Oh, the limitations. The reason there's so many of them is for somebody to have that feeling of belonging. When I first tried to get clean, I started going to AA meetings. And it's a great fellowship, but I couldn't relate. You know, I never wrecked my pickup truck and beat my wife. I took all my money and locked myself in the bathroom, you know. And I couldn't relate to their stories, and that's what I was looking for. So I heard this differentness, and I disallowed myself. Well, that's not for me. So I went back out and got sicker. And in NA, for me, when I first sat down, when I first went to my first meeting, I remember it really clear. Because there was people in there talking about my story, and they were saying that they don't do that today, and they get this other life, and you know. So it's kind of the empathy, you know, is the real problem. That's why there's so many of them.
Feminists have critiqued, and it hasn't come down well on speaking to them. It has some real male history and kind of patriarchal. And there's been some good critiquing by that. I think, you know, the meetings and the groups are so varied that you often hear, you know, you just got to keep going to different meetings until you find one that fits your personality, because they are so diverse. But I think they do in some way speak to a lot of black and white thinking sometimes, and it can attract people that can certainly kind of exploit some of the wisdom that's there in to vulnerable people. But generally I'd say, and most often people have said that some of those criticisms still don't outweigh all of the benefits. Do you want to add anything else to it? Or anybody else?
You said something about getting addicted to the steps.
Yeah, that's
an obvious one. But as far as what you were saying about limitations because it doesn't address oppression, because it's not political, because you're not attacking political organizations or class or something, I think it goes way beyond it and goes through it. I think it comes down to love and fear. It's about service. I was reading, it's like the December 12th meditation. You know, it talks about we're either operating out of love or we're operating out of fear. Hey, I heard that from a systematic theologian and he said that's what Christianity comes down to. Boom. So here's someone that never read the same books that systematic theologian came to that same point. So this is it. This is bedrock. You're either operating out of love or fear. I once talked to a Catholic priest that said, have you heard the seven deadly sins? And I said, yeah. And he goes, well, do you know why they're called the deadly sins? I said, well, they're really bad, right? And he said, no, because by practicing any one of them, you can kill yourself. Mm-hmm. I don't know where that came from. it meant something to me. No, thank you. But I really do think that the limitations in the program, there are some. But on the other hand, it opens the person up to ultimate truths. And it, from my experience, it never pigeonholes someone. It does more opening up, and it really, you center it down to the very basic questions of who I am, what is life, getting some real child of God thought, and then you start branching out to society and the way the people that really work the program, the way that they work, that, you know, it's in community, and I don't think it has any more limitations than the church as body of Christ has. It's some very similar core stuff, I think.
Two more, and then we'll wrap it up.
Yeah, I got a two-part question. As someone from outside of a 12-step program, if I'm aware of someone who has been part of, for example, AA, has been going to meetings, and I'm aware that person has stopped going to meetings, and I say to the person, are you still going to meetings? And the person says, no, I'm not going anymore. What is my responsibility? Not as one kind of as an outsider, and yet connected with that person. Secondly, if I'm aware that a person has perhaps even with me, done the fifth step, and then I see the person drinking, again, as a person not in the 12-step program, what is my responsibility to that person? Is it to contact someone in AA and say you don't invite them to come back? What is the role of someone as an observer?
Can I be a wise guy? Go to a CODA meeting.
But he's asking a very, as far as pastors, that they need to know this stuff. I mean, I took a course at the seminary, and part of that was that, and it's tricky stuff. How much you can do, because you can't get anyone to start working the steps. So it sort of follows that you can't get someone to go back and work the steps. But on the other hand, you know, you've got a clear responsibility. If you're talking about a member of your congregation, It's, I don't know. I mean, I don't know the answer.
Well, Bill is referring to Codependence Anonymous, which is the organization that I would come from that point of view, where my behavior has been supporting that of an addicted person, or that the person's addiction is controlling my behavior, and that I feel that I'm responsible for that person. I'm not responsible for any other person, you know, on this earth. All people are responsible for themselves, and I'm not responsible to see that person takes care of themselves. That's a sickness that I have, when I feel responsible to do something to that person, or to push them in some cubbyhole, or try to make them do what I know is best for them. You know, I know it's best for them, but until that person knows it's best for them, it doesn't make any difference at all to that person, and they will react negatively to my trying to push them into something. Particularly a person who's ever gone through the 12-step process and been involved in it, they know what's good for them. And as soon as they want to do it, they'll do it.
I'd like to encourage you to have more conversation with some of the folks here. I know I'd like to. I want to give you a chance to.
Thank you, Jackie.
Speak.
In your introductory remarks, you spoke of the fifth step as something of a confession, as something confessional in nature. And the fifth step work I've done, I've always been told that it really isn't a confession, because it doesn't call for an absolution. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe that's one of the limitations of the mm-hmm. program, is in fact, there is no absolution. There is no declaration of forgiveness in this program.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to say one of the joys for me in seeing 12-step involvement has been, very often it's been a reintroduction to someone's faith tradition, or reconciling to a tradition, kind of much like what Bill talked about. People who have sort of, you know, shunned away the organized church and said, I don't want anything to do with it. And then they come through a 12-step program, and somehow they realize that it's a spiritual program, but they need a deeper relationship to this higher power, and they then either enter or kind of check back their old experience with church and see how it feels, and maybe it fits now, maybe it doesn't. Or people who enter it as, you know, totally faithless, and say, you know, and in the process have some kind of, what I would say, really a conversion kind of experience, and say, I need to define this higher power more. And then for the first time, we'll go and explore some kind of faith. And that has been the real joy for me, to see that either be a reconciling experience or an introduction, you know, to the, you know, for the first time. I just want to close with a quote by a pastor who is talking about reflecting on how churchgoers are often embarrassed or distrustful or have false respectability for the 12 steps. And she says, she compared the faceless men and women meeting at the church to the prodigal son of Jesus' parable. They've hit bottom and are on a journey home. But instead of celebrating their return with a fatted calf like the father in the parable, she said, too many church members are more like the parable's elder brother who balks at this welcome. So I invite people to stay for the Compline service. It'll start at 9:45. But in the spirit of the topic tonight, why don't we close with the Serenity Prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Keep coming backwards.
Thanks to our panelists, to all of you.